Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It has been my distinct pleasure to get to know in recent years a man who has served in a variety of capacities in that war, notably working for my old boss, President Ronald Reagan, and George H.W. Bush, in their respective White Houses. It is an opportunity, of course, to take stock with Robert Charles about some of his experiences with the latter as we mourn his passing. He has also more recently served in the George W. Bush administration as an Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs. He's a former naval person, naval intelligence officer, as well as a litigator and an extraordinarily welcome guest, always. It's good to have you, Robert. Congratulations again on your new book, Evergreens and Eagles. It's great to have you with us, as always.
I thank you, Frank, very much.
So, at least a quick word on the passing of George H.W. Bush, your experiences with him, and why we should be particularly mindful of his service to our country.
You know, I think, Frank, things happen always for reasons, and this passing at this time is really poignant for a number of reasons. You have a wonderful man, not just a wonderful president, and someone who, two phrases come to my mind regularly when I think of him, having worked in his White House. One is sort of a quiet nobility in that he was a noble soul. He got up every day animated by his faith, and also by a sense, I think, of wanting to do good for others individually, which is the way he handled people one-on-one as well as world leaders. The other thing, I think, is the idea of selfless service. A lot of people serve in the government or otherwise, but he really had the idea that what he was doing was for a larger cause than himself. And, you know, I am reminded of a couple of stories that really draw on his past as well as the time in the White House. You know, this is a young man who finished high school 6 months after the Pearl Harbor attack, immediately before college, immediately jumped in and volunteered to be a naval aviator, flew a TBM Avenger off the decks of the San Jacinto in the Pacific, was shot down. And actually, while his plane burned, he nursed it. He first delivered his payload from a burning plane and then nursed it out to sea and bailed. Was picked up by the Finback. By strange chance, someone in my hometown actually served with the president on the San Jacinto. And the memory that they had was it was remarkable that this young man was back in a TBM Avenger flying missions again in less than 30 days. So never was there a break in his conviction. And that, of course, took him through the head of the CIA, a member of Congress, a UN ambassador, actually the acting, in effect, ambassador to China, and eventually Ronald Reagan's great and quiet and dutiful, dutiful and really selfless vice president and president. The story, I suppose there are many stories, but the one I'll tell you is one that you may relate to yourself, having served with President Reagan. President Bush would often give speeches at military bases and at the national academies for the military. And whenever one of these came up, I was a young staffer in his White House, and I would put in, we were given chances to look at the speeches and maybe add something, and I would always put in lines that related the military service of those to whom he was speaking back to his own military service, and whether I mentioned combat or naval aviator or the Navy. And invariably, when the speech was given, it didn't have those lines in it. And so I finally went down one night, late at night, to the chief speechwriter, and I said, "What gives? You know, here's a wonderful president, an opportunity to speak about this, middle of the 1992 campaign, Desert Storm, Desert Shield prior to that." He said, "Bobby, join the club. Everybody puts lines in like that. And after the third or fourth time that you go over to the Oval and they draw a red line, the president takes out a pen, quietly draws a red line through them. You don't put them in anymore. The way he feels about it is, either the American people know that he's a bona fides war hero, or it's not his right to tell them." And I think that level of nobility and quietude and humility, really, is something that we were blessed with in Ronald Reagan. We were blessed with it in George Herbert Walker Bush. And it's something that we as Americans like leaders who are not only good at what they do and confident in what they do and effective at what they do, but also are good people. And he honestly was one of the best.
Thank you for that tribute. It's great to have it on our air, Robert Charles. Let me turn to another topic on which, again, you have considerable expertise, the border issue. This caravan business, Robert, since we last spoke, has continued to metastasize, particularly for the people of Mexico, Tijuana notably. There is great and growing reason to believe that there are some very bad actors involved in at least the caravan that is at the gates at the moment, and others probably behind them. You have spoken with me in the past about the concerns that you have of, among others, drug traffickers and perhaps terrorists being in the mix. What should be done here, and what are they doing in the courts that seem to be thwarting every effort by the president to protect us against such threats?
Yeah, you know, let me hit that as both the courts and the media, Frank, because you always speak the truth to the American people. And I think it's an enormous service to all of us. And I listen when I'm not speaking. But I think in this particular situation, the courts, first of all, are hamstringing a president who has executive prerogatives to protect the border. And that means he has the right to offer time, place, and manner restrictions, and he can decide how various laws are enforced, because that's his job, is the executor, the executive branch. The key that the media is not talking about, and this is really critical, and it's a legal issue that's critical, is that the whole idea of what a refugee is comes from a 1951 definition that the United States has always lived by. And that definition is that if you have a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group, or a specific political opinion, and it is identified as a persecution of you individually or you for that reason, then you are permitted to be reviewed. There's a review process that goes on if you want to be an asylee. What happened in Latin America is that in 1984, the Latin American countries, including Mexico, all got together and they issued something called the Cartagena Declaration. And what it did is it said, well, for all of us, just among ourselves here, we're going to throw out that legal opinion. And we're going to adopt something that we call our own refugee status. And that basically says, you'll be allowed into my country if, as an asylee, if you, quote, fled your country because of safety, freedom, economic problems, violence, foreign aggression, internal conflict, if you felt like it. And you know, the media is not covering this important distinction. This is a distinction that is a difference and a significant material distinction. The United States of America does not let you into this country if you come from a place that's just violent and poor. If we did that, we'd have everybody from China to Syria in our country. We don't do that. The Latin American countries, because of their own mutual assistance and because of a lot of instability over the years, adopted a much wider definition of refugee. And the reason that a lot of these refugees are misinformed about what their asylum rights are, or at least opportunities are at our border, they are not institutionally entitled to constitutional rights. But the reason they're misinformed is that they're working off their own internal definitions.
This is a subject we're going to have to come back to with you, Robert. Thank you for your service to our country, going back to the Reagan and Bush times as well as more recently. Come back to us again very soon, if you would.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Gordon Chang, one of our country's preeminent experts on matters involving Asia, and most especially China, and what it is up to. And who better to talk to than a columnist for the Daily Beast, the author of two terrific best-selling books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. A man you see frequently at Fox and at other outlets, but we're always pleased is with us, to specifically visit about this new, well, deal, we are told, has been struck by President Trump with his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping, in Buenos Aires over the weekend. Gordon, it's good to have you back. You were anticipating something like this. Tell us what you think came of it all.
Well, the president announced a 90-day truce with China. And yesterday, Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, said that the Chinese made commitments totaling $1.2 trillion, although he didn't detail the nature of those commitments. Probably more buying of agricultural products, maybe some structural reforms. I think it was a mistake for the president to delay the confrontation with Beijing, because remember, every day that they delay, the Chinese steal more and more intellectual property from the U.S. And 90 days means maybe $70, $80, $90 billion of U.S. IP. Plus, also, there are a number of other factors that I think make the Chinese stronger at the end of the 90-day period and us a little bit weaker. But in any event, we do have overwhelming leverage over China. The only issue is political will. And on Saturday at that dinner, President Trump showed that he did not have the political will to confront the Chinese.
So you don't credit the idea that he's giving them another chance and the hammer will come down in another 90 days, specifically with respect to further escalation of tariffs?
The hammer may come down and probably will come down, but it should have come down earlier. Got to remember, Frank, that we had last year the 100-day action plan, which was announced by Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross right after the Mar-a-Lago meeting between Xi Jinping and Trump. And the issue really is, how many chances do we really need to give the Chinese? Because this comes after decades of broken promises on the part of China. And so I think that this is the time to actually enforce the obligations that China has undertaken, and also as well to prevent them from continuing their criminal conduct.
Yeah. And there's very little doubt in your mind, I take it, Gordon, based on all of that hard experience, that we will see them continuing to break their promises, continuing to steal our technology, continuing to wage, well, more broadly, I guess, economic warfare against this country.
Oh, certainly, Frank. You know, they will continue to do that until we force them to stop. And the only way to force them to stop is to impose costs that are greater than the benefits they receive. You know, I think President Trump was on a really good path in trying to disengage from the Chinese economy. But if you do have this deal that Secretary Mnuchin talks about, we'll be further entangling ourselves with Beijing. And I don't believe that that's the correct approach at this time. You know, we've tried that now for decades. You know, we had decades of agreements, negotiations, WTO cases. All of those tactics have failed. The only tactic that has not failed is disengagement. And I think we need to go along that path.
Gordon, I think it's been since we last talked that a new report came out of the Hoover Institution, edited by Larry Diamond, in which quite a number of prominent China hands, if you will, were asked to opine about what's going on with the Chinese and what we should be doing about their influence operations, their economic warfare, and so on. Many of them sounded a lot like you, as a matter of fact, which is all the more striking because they haven't, by and large, to this point. There's been this sort of general consensus, I think we would call it, among the China expert community that we need to just engage and they'll peacefully rise and all will be well. It seems as though the scales are falling off of a lot of eyes. What did you make of this Hoover Institution report? Not that it surprises you in terms of, I guess, the content in terms of the truth, but that people seem to be coming around to your point of view.
There's a simple explanation for that, and that is the Chinese are leaving people no choice but to come to more realistic positions. You can always count on the Chinese to create the opposition to them, and that's exactly what's occurring now.
And is it in part a function that they've stopped giving visas to these folks, that is beginning to eliminate a powerful incentive to conform to Chinese party lines?
There are a lot of factors, Frank. I think the most important one is, Xi Jinping's move to eliminate the term limits for his least important post, which is the presidency, I think crystallized thinking not only in the United States, but also in China as well, that Xi Jinping was not going to be moving in the right directions. There's been a lot of evidence to that effect. I mean, we know that he was an ultra-nationalist even before he became general party secretary. But during his first 5 years at the top of China, I mean, he made it clear that Beijing was going to move in all the wrong ways. Mm-hmm.
And Gordon, there seems nonetheless to be some restiveness within the Chinese Communist Party about his leadership, and that some are evidently being discerned as critical of him over having this confrontation with Donald Trump. And I gather there's a fair amount of spinning going on now inside China about this this so-called deal. What are you making of what is happening on the ground there?
I think you're absolutely right. Xi Jinping, because he's basically taken over the job of Li Keqiang, the premier, has now made himself responsible for everything. And that means that when things go well, this is really good for Xi Jinping. When things go badly, things are not so good for the leader. If Xi Jinping is perceived to have humiliated the United States, this is going to strengthen Xi Jinping. So far, though, that's not the perception. The perception is that this confrontation with the U.S. was premature and unnecessary. So it's important for Trump to win this. And so far, he's not winning it, or at least didn't win it at that round on Saturday. So this could give new life to Xi Jinping, especially if there's this $1.2 trillion deal, as Mnuchin says. So there's a lot riding on this. And I do hope that on March 1st, which is the 91st day after that dinner, that the United States puts those tariffs on if there's no agreement that's acceptable.
Yeah, brings the hammer down. Gordon, of course, one of the manifestations of what the Chinese are up to is, I think it's fair to say, what the North Koreans are up to. And they're being backed up in behavior that is a little worrying, shall we say, including inside South Korea. There are reports of sort of radical pro-North Korean thugs engaging in violence or threats of violence against those who oppose North Korea inside South Korea. There are also reports of cyber warfare being waged by the North Koreans against the South. This at a moment when the South Korean government is seemingly working towards a separate peace with North Korea. What's going on as you see it?
Well, Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, is deeply anti-American. And last year, President Trump did an excellent job of boxing him in, preventing Moon from getting what he wanted. This year, though, Trump has let up the pressure and Moon has really moved to support North Korea. And one of those ways, as you mentioned, is that he's allowed in South Korea pro-North Korea thugs to make death threats, to raid the offices of journalists, to do all sorts of things to destabilize South Korea. And unfortunately, the United States has not done enough this year to prevent Moon from undermining the alliance with South Korea, undermining our joint security, not doing enough to prevent Moon from supporting the North Korean economy with cash. President Trump at the Ottawa G7, which was just before the summit with Kim Jong-un in Singapore, said that he was giving Kim a one-time shot to do the right thing. Well, during this one-time shot, not only has Kim taken advantage of it to undermine us and not to denuclearize, but Moon has also taken the opportunity to bust sanctions and support North Korea. President Trump needs to enforce some discipline on this situation. And if he doesn't, things are going to get out of control.
Yeah, I fear that's the case. And the most worrying bit of that would be, of course, if Kim Jong-un reads what's happening in South Korea as an invitation to act even more belligerently. And I don't think that can be ruled out, given the nature of that dynasty and this particular individual. Let me ask you quickly, Gordon, one last thing. ZTE keeps popping up, the Chinese conglomerate telecommunications giant, state-owned or effectively state-owned, I think it's fair to say, in Venezuela, using apparently American software there in violation of some understandings that I think President Trump had with Xi Jinping about this company. Can you give us a read on what's going on there and how would this benefit the Venezuelans and the Chinese to our detriment?
Well, ZTE is under a settlement agreement with the United States. It violated Iran and North Korea sanctions, came to a settlement agreement some time ago, violated that. In April of this year, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross imposed a 7-year ban on transactions between the American companies and ZTE. That was a death sentence. We modified it, which was a mistake. And now ZTE has violated the second settlement agreement. I think that this is time to put ZTE out of its misery. Although it's not state-owned, it is, of course, state-controlled in a sense. And so this is the Chinese government violating its commitments to us. And this was a written commitment. So, you know, this also goes back to the whole thing about the 90-day truce on trade. How can you trust the Chinese when they continually dishonor the promises, written promises, that they make to us?
Yeah, I think it's hard not to see it as evidence of contempt. Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for joining us today and for all that you do at The Daily Beast and Fox News and elsewhere. Next up, we'll speak with Seth Cropsey right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We have the privilege of being joined by Seth Cropsey, a man who has served his country in a host of capacities, including as a naval officer for some 19 years, but also in senior roles in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, including one we both had the extraordinary good fortune to serve, Caspar Weinberger, during the Reagan administration. He also went on to be a deputy undersecretary of the Navy and has these days continued his important work on behalf of the maritime capabilities of the United States as the director of the Center for American Sea Power with the Hudson Institute. His name is Seth Cropsey. He has done, in addition to all of that, two really important books lately, Mayday, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy, and Sea Blindness. Seth Cropsey, it's good to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Frank. It's always a pleasure.
Well, let's start with a couple of very important developments in the maritime space. One is this bridge that the Russians have built over something called the Kerch Strait, which only seemed to get attention when they decided to use it, as seemed likely, to essentially blockade Ukrainian access to the Sea of Azov, in whose waters the Ukrainians have a lot of territory adjacent and some very important ports. Tell us what that's all about, Seth. What are the Russians up to, and what are the stakes in this current confrontation?
Well, the Russians, as usual, are up to aggression against Ukraine. The primary issue here is control of waters that are important to Ukraine and extending the area that Putin thinks he can control so as to deny access and area denial to shipping, in this case, that of Ukraine's. Despite an agreement that was signed between 13 years ago, between Ukraine and Russia that defined maritime space and allowed both countries to come and go freely between the Black Sea and the much smaller Sea of Azov.
And when you see a bridge of, I think it's 115 feet above the water, placed in a manner to essentially obstruct any vessel that has a mass higher than that from entering that Sea of Azov or exiting from it, would this be considered an out-and-out violation of not only that agreement with Ukraine, but also more broadly international law?
Well, it would affect the Russians also, because their ships headed for Russian ports have to go underneath the same bridge. I think that the way I look at the bridge is that it's sort of Russia's version of the Chinese building of reefs into islands and then arming them. It's laying a marker down And the harassment of Ukrainian shipping didn't really begin in earnest until after the bridge was built. So it's more of a geographic marking and a demonstration of Russian presence than it is an obstacle to shipping.
But the stakes, to the extent that the Russians are now enforcing essentially a blockade of at least Ukrainian access to the Azov Sea with the seizure of these three vessels that were trying to pass under that bridge. What about that, as you see it, Seth? Serious problem?
No, I think it's definitely a serious problem. It's Russian aggression, and it becomes a more serious problem when he's allowed to get away with it.
That is the rub. That is the rub, indeed. And I think that's what he was quite confident would be the case, don't you think? When we're saying he, you mean Vladimir Putin in this case, I take it.
Look, the large issue here is not so much the details of the bridge and the maritime delineation lines within the sea. The larger issue is that Russia broke the law, broke agreements that it had signed, and gotten away with it, at least so far. And that tells them information that is useful to them and thinking that in a more dangerous way in other places, like in the Black Sea itself or in the Baltic.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, Seth Cropsey. You've done a lot of thinking about maritime strategy and the capabilities to execute it to protect our vital interests. Is the Black Sea one of those places that we should be concerned? The Russians are now increasingly turning into their, sort of private lake?
Very concerned. We have three NATO allies with large, significant coastlines on the Black Sea. One of them is not so much an ally in Rio as it is in name, that is Turkey. But Romania is very much an ally. Bulgaria is a member of NATO as well. So it certainly makes a difference to their security, to their ability to come and go, to use the international waters freely for commerce and for security. The incident in the Sea of Azov has tremendous implications for the Black Sea.
Yeah. So, Seth, if you were advising this president, as you did two others, President Reagan, President George H.W. Bush, who's passing, we are mourning these days, what would you recommend be done by the United States Navy or U.S. government more generally?
Increase of military assistance to Ukraine, especially assistance to their what's left of their Navy. And if we had the ships available, put a couple of smaller vessels, either frigate size or maybe the littoral combat ship, as a constant presence in the Black Sea, which would be very difficult because by the Montreux Convention, the foreign warships can only stay there for 3 weeks at a time. So that would mean if you put two in, they'd have to come out after 3 weeks and another two would have to take their place. But that would send a very strong signal both to our NATO allies and to the Russians that we're serious about protecting our allies and maintaining the international waters of the Black Sea as international waters.
Would you expect there to be a problem? As you alluded to, Turkey is, in my view, an ally no more. Would it, as the master of the Bosporus Strait, give us a hard time about putting warships inside the Black Sea these days?
Well, they haven't been giving us a hard time about ships that have gone in there to date. So it's a reasonable question whether they would whether they'd go along with what amounts to maintaining an effective constant presence there. But the Turks are, although relations are good with Russia, or relatively good with Russia these days, Turkey, despite Erdogan's bluster, knows that the history of Turkish-Russian relations is not a happy one.
Right. and doesn't want to anger the Kremlin, presumably. You've mentioned the literal combat ship, and as a man who has spent a lot of time both inside the United States Navy as an officer as well as a civilian official, I know, again, you've given a lot of thought to the kinds of ships that we need and the necessity for having considerably more than we do. The literal combat ship is essentially, as I understand it, a glorified coastal vessel, and not all that glorified for that matter. Is it part of an actual sort of blue water Navy capability of the kind that we need? And do you think it would, if you had two or three of them in the Black Sea, the Russians would regard it as much of a, you know, presence to speak of?
I think that the Russians would take it seriously. The problem with the littoral combat ship is not that it can't operate in the oceans. The problems so far have been with the weapon systems, their delivery, the construction of the modules that the ship is based on. The modules means different outfittings for different combat missions. And also the ship's defenses against air attack. Those are the problems there. But assuming that the Russians are not intending to start a war with the United States that begins with or includes aerial bombardment of U.S. Navy ships, I think they'd do the job just fine. It's a larger logistic question.
Yeah, the Russians have, as you know, as I understand it, used what's been described as electromagnetic pulse, or certainly harassing overflights over their vessels when they have been in the Black Sea of late. And I'm always concerned that these things have a propensity to turn into miscalculations and get us into something far worse. And I just wonder whether you want to have vessels that can't even defend themselves on station in that event.
I don't, and I certainly agree with former Secretary of Defense Hagel's conclusion that the ships are insufficiently armed and that changes need to be made, and those changes are underway. And it points, I think, toward the larger question of a new frigate for the Navy to replace the aging and disappearing ones that we have. And I mean, you know, this opens up a whole can of worms.
It does. It actually opens up a whole other topic of conversation. I think we need to get you back for an hour, Seth, if you'll do it. It's been too long. So do come back to us soon, if you would. In the meantime, keep up the great work at the Hudson Institute, my friend. Next up, we will speak with Kevin Freeman right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We have the extraordinary good fortune to have with us a man who has moved from one of the country's foremost experts on economic warfare and best-selling author and weekly visitor on our program here at Secure Freedom Radio, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, to now one of the founding members of a very exciting new media, well, I guess it's premature to call it empire, but perhaps it will be that in not too distant future. Blaze Media. He is, of course, Kevin Freeman, a regular featured guest here at Secure Freedom Radio, and we're always happy to have him with us, but especially to tell us about this new merging of the House of Mark Levin and the House of Glenn Beck and what it might mean for Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, your own program, and, well, the fate of the free world, for that matter. Kevin, welcome. Good to have you. Tell us about all that.
Thank you, Frank. Well, it's good to be here. Yes, it was announced on Sunday that CRTV, which is the host to my program, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, plus Phil Robertson and Steven Crowder and Steve Dace and Mark Levin, and you know, just a whole group of phenomenal conservative thought leaders has joined forces with Glenn Beck's company, and we've created Blaze Media, and it is going to reach 168 million people on a daily basis. We've got website, we've got subscription-based television, we've got linear television that can be seen on Dish and cable systems. So it really is a powerhouse, and I think it's a great opportunity for conservative voices that don't always agree on every point, but always agree on personal liberty as opposed to autocratic control.
For those of us who have been subscribing to you at economicwarroom.com, how will they be impacted in the future, or what other options are there to take advantage of your broadcasting? And as important as your broadcasting itself, of course, the blueprints that you also make available to your listeners to implement the kinds of insights and recommendations that you provide so powerfully in Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman.
Well, the battle plans will continue, and they'll stay available. Nothing's going to change except the logo that goes in the corner will say Blaze TV as opposed to CRTV. We'll continue forward. But I was a subscriber to Glenn Beck's service, and I was also a subscriber to CRTV. So now I have 2 years, you know, because I bought a 1 year to both. They just doubled it up, so I've got a 2-year subscription, and it just rapidly expands. Now, you know, for that same subscription price, you go to economicwarroom.com. We're running a special Econ Christmas, save $20. So for $79, you get all of the things that you would have paid $100 a year for with the old Blaze, and all the things that you would have paid $100 a year for at CRTV. For $79, you get both of those and a free month.
A deal. Fabulous. Well, congratulations, Kevin. We're looking forward to seeing much more of you in these new media outlets, and I'm very excited for the rest of the team as well. Hey, let me take an opportunity quickly to get a second opinion here. I spoke earlier in the program with Gordon Chang about the so-called deal that has been struck between President Trump and President Xi Jinping of China. It is described in some places a deal. Larry Kudlow, I believe, has been quoted as saying that it's a very detailed plan with very strong commitments by the Chinese. The Chinese seem to be casting it somewhat differently in their own media, especially for domestic consumption. There is another line, which is simply that there's just a pause. It's not really a deal at all. It's just an opportunity for further conversations between the two parties about trade issues, among other things, for the next 90 days, at the end of which time, perhaps, as Gordon anticipates, the hammer will have to come down on the Chinese. What's your reading on it, Kevin Freeman? And as you understand better than just about anybody what the Chinese are doing in terms of economic warfare against us, and have been for many years, is it advisable for us to be pausing, let alone cutting some sort of deal with them?
Well, I think there are two overriding truths. One of the truths is that it is a pause. There is no structural deal that's in place here. It's a pause. It's an agreement not to, to go forward. And I think it benefits both parties at your end for a variety of reasons. So the first point is I agree it's a pause, and there will have to be a substantive, hard-hitting response that will come 90 days from now. I think we can't continue on the path that we were on. It will lead to really bad things down the road. The Chinese are committing economic warfare, and I doubt that they will fully pause that. But it's from the market standpoint, which goes to my second point, from the market's perspective, the pause is good news. We saw the stock market rally substantially yesterday on the hopes that maybe we can work this trade thing out. And I think that's as much of motivation as anything, is the stock market was going down because the Federal Reserve kept raising interest rates, and the Fed chairman said recently, hey, we're close to maybe neutral, and so maybe we don't have to raise four times next year, and that cheered the stock market. And the second thing was the idea that we're not in this, going into this massive bad trade war with massive tariff increases and so forth. So I think if anything, it was motivated by a desire on our end. President Trump did not want to see a bad stock market in the holidays. We had a horrible Thanksgiving week, so I think that's part of it. And on the other side, for the Chinese, I think that their economy was slowing. I think their trading partners were getting anxious and upset, and I think they wanted the pause as well. I do not see this as a conclusive end to the trade problems that we have with them, though.
Yeah. Well, my biggest concern about this, I have to say, Kevin, is that there clearly is a lot more going on here than just trade. And what I'm most especially concerned about is that if for the shortest of term calculations, so, you know, a stock market at Christmas time, for example, we are signaling to the Chinese that we are once again going to be playing along with the false promises that they routinely serve up, buying them more time, creating new opportunities, as Gordon pointed out, for, you know, them to engage in still further intellectual property theft and the like, that this may net be rather bad for the United States. I just wondered what, as you look particularly at the insistent effort the Chinese are making, just to pick one example, to displace the dollar as the reserve currency of the world, and the help that they now seem increasingly to be getting from the Europeans for de-dollarization, as it's called. Even CNBC, which has long denied that this kind of thing is afoot, is now recognizing that it is in play. How do you put this pause or deal or whatever it actually turns out to be in that context, Kevin? Does it make sense in light of what the Chinese are really doing in the way of economic warfare against us?
Well, first, I agree that this is a serious problem that's beyond just trade. The market wants to view it as a trade problem. It's not. It is an economic war problem. And second, I would agree with you that a pause in which we truly pause and aren't very aggressive, but will open the door of opportunity for them to continue to be aggressive. They lie to us all the time. They make a promise, we're not going to hack you anymore, and then they keep hacking. They make a promise, ZTE, we're not going to violate the sanctions, and then they violate the sanctions. And we've seen all of that recently. What their main goal in the dollar is to make us bleed. If they can make the dollar look to where it is not the solid reserve currency of the world that you can trust, then others like Europe will say, well, the euro has its seat at the table. And if they can create those level of dissensions in the Western world to where we're fighting over who the reserve currency, we've already lost. They're proceeding. It is economic warfare. I'm hopeful that behind the scenes, I wouldn't count President Trump out. He's a skillful negotiator. He somehow pulls off these miracle deals. So I wouldn't count him out. But I do not view the pause as necessarily a good thing. I think we should take the high ground and then we should win aggressively.
Meaning that the hammer does come down at the end of 90 days. But also, I agree with you. I think the president has a pretty clear view of what the Chinese are up to. And that's my very strong hope that will inform his decision making going forward. Thank you for your time to discuss all of that today, Kevin. Again, congratulations on Blaze Media. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. And to talking with the rest of you, again, I hope tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.